The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Paul Ryan shocked pundits and citizens alike in late November when he showed up to the Capitol sporting a beard. Ryan pointed out in a tweet that he was the first House Speaker to don a beard on the floor in roughly a century. Will Paul Ryan's facial hair mark a new trend of politicians growing it out, or is it just a blip on the timeline of facial fashion? Well, Phil Edwards is a video editor at Vox, where he also writes about ephemera, including the history of facial hair. Phil, great to have you back with us.
Good to be here.
So first, a fact check. Has it indeed been 100 years since a speaker had facial hair?
The House actually released information about when the last speaker was to have facial hair. And it's been rare in the past, and it's pretty rare today, too.
Well, you've written a couple articles about the history of facial hair, which made me laugh, actually. I mean, what are your sources? Who's studying facial hair trends?
Yeah, so there are a few different ways to look at it. As far as the past goes, there have actually been some interesting sociologists who have looked at facial hair over time. The way that one of them did it was he combed through years upon years of the Illustrated News of London to see whether or not people had facial hair in those various newspaper issues. And the thinking was that by looking at pictures of people who were fancy and elite enough to see whether or not they appeared in the Illustrated News in London, he could figure out exactly how elite or fancy beards were. And it turned out that there were definite trends and ups and downs for beards in history.
Well, tell us about some of those trends. When did they come and go?
As far as the facial hair trends go, in London, you saw a real peak for sideburns and mustaches in sort of the mid to late 1800s, and then it went way downhill once the 1900s passed. And that roughly correlates with what we saw in the U.S., though the data there is a little more anecdotal. One of the reasons that you could point to as far as why beards fell out of favor is that the safety razor became a thing. So it suddenly became a lot easier to shave, and therefore it became easier to maintain a style that didn't depend on you growing a beard. But more importantly than that, I think there's a fashion element, and there always has been, in which a certain type of beard got trendy or became popular in a certain area, and people grew it in response to that trend. And like all trends, it faded, and suddenly beards became to symbolize something totally different.
Well, facial hair is still very big in Brooklyn, but as you pointed out, has not been popular for politicians. You looked at some of the most recent headshots for Congress. Now, this is as of September 2015. What did you see?
Yeah, so I went through every photo of every member in Congress and looked at whether or not they had hair on their face. And it's exciting to me because it's already outdated because of what Paul Ryan did. But
you
it's
mean
still
he started a trend?
Well, I think he's definitely a turning point in it, because when I made this chart, Paul Ryan was had not yet grown his facial hair. He was not yet going to be Speaker of the House. And as a result, you saw that it was pretty sparse. As far as facial hair in Congress goes, it was relegated to a very few members of Congress and maybe a couple of people in like Western districts who might have some of the countercultural associations that we have with the beard. So I think that Paul Ryan represents a sort of turning point in which the beard is hitting yet another mainstream politician. So I wonder if maybe it symbolizes that the beard is becoming more mainstream than it has in the past. Because when I made this chart, it seemed like it was still a countercultural thing, even though you're seeing it creep into business and other more staid corners of our society.
I was just thinking about what it symbolizes. I mean, growing a beard certainly is a commitment, but also can be a sign of a kind of laziness or dropping out. I'm thinking of Al Gore. You know, he didn't get the presidency, and he grew a beard. It's sort of sign that he's given up or he's out of the game. So what's the line there between intention and like, ugh, forget it. I'm just not shaving.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what you saw some of the punditry be with Paul Ryan as well. And then you also have Bill Richardson. He grew a beard after his presidential bid failed. John Kerry grew a beard for a while. So it seems like the pattern among politicians, and definitely the analysis that follows politicians' decisions to grow their beard, is that it is a sign of giving up higher aspirations. And because that's become such a meme, it's tough to know if there's going to be a way back there to the point in which a beard symbolizes virility or success or some greater thing rather than just kind of not wanting to bother with shaving because you're too depressed.
How about, speaking of that, virility and, you know, power, what about presidents? When was the last presidential beard?
Yeah, so it's kind of depends how you define a full beard. Of course, most people might know that William Howard Taft, he was known for being a rather overweight president. And so he has a very flamboyant mustache, as did his immediate predecessor, Theodore Roosevelt. But before that, you have to go back to Benjamin Harrison, who's kind of the end of that series of bearded presidents that we all remember from looking at the chart of presidents in elementary school, just this random patch of bearded guys in the 1800s, the late 1880s. And some people theorize that for them, it was a way of showing that they were of a certain generation, that they were elite, and also that they had ties to the Civil War generation in which a lot of generals had beards. So that's why you have Ulysses S. Grant and then Rutherford B. Hayes. In the 1800s, it was this very potent symbol of war and of being part of the establishment. And then that eventually faded away once the turn of the century happened.
So, Phil, what do you think the response would be if President Obama just decided, okay, going for broke now, and puts down the razor, grows a beard in his last year in office?
Yeah, well, I had an idea that you might ask about this, and I do have some bad news. In 2006, he did tell one reporter that he was unable to grow a really good beard.
Oh,
he could
no.
kind of just come up with whiskers. Yes, it's very sad. I share President Obama's malady. I can only get a bad beard as well. So I feel bad for his prospects there. And I know that you don't want to try to grow a beard if you can't. However, if he were to grow a beard, I think that it would probably break down along partisan lines, just like everything else. I think supporters would probably say that it's showing how he's taking charge of the presidency in redefining fashion. And people who are against the president would probably say it's a sign that he's given up. So I think that beards, like anything, can be partisan. That said, I'd love to see it. And, you know, I personally encourage him to give it a try, even if it's just whiskers. I think it would be interesting.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for that cutting political analysis, among other things.
Yes, cutting or shaving, either way.
Phil Edwards is video editor for Vox, where he also writes about ephemera. You can find links to read several of his articles about the history of facial hair at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, for the record, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan did get rid of the beard. He appeared before the House clean-shaven on Tuesday. And while we may not have any bearded candidates in the current presidential race, that did not stop us from reimagining them with facial hair, thanks to Photoshop. Want to see what Governor Jeb Bush would look like rocking a stash? Bernie Sanders going full Brooklyn with beard and a man bun? Donald Trump with exuberant facial hair? Well, check out the highly entertaining gallery. It's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And you can get there from Facebook or Twitter. At this stage in the presidential primary, contenders are not only trying to accumulate votes in the early voting states, but fighting for party influence. It is what some political junkies call the invisible primary. That's the behind-the-curtain battle for big donors, endorsements, and yes, political surrogates, the notable colleagues and celebrities who campaign for them. Here in New Hampshire, we're privy to some of the big wig surrogates out knocking on doors and shaking hands. And joining us now to talk about who is stumping for whom and why that matters is Akilah Johnson. She's a political reporter for the Boston Globe covering the New Hampshire primary. Akilah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So if this were a contest, who would be winning the surrogate wars on both the Democratic and Republican sides of the election so far?
Well, right now, if it were a contest, Hillary Clinton would definitely be right up there. She is racking them in. There's her husband, who was in town, you know, the former president, President Bill Clinton. If you're a fan of the HBO hit series Girls, Lena Dunham is scheduled to come in town to stump for her. So she's got, like, big names like that. Then she's got some folks who might be a little more obscure, shall we say.
Well, Lena Dunham, that's certainly bringing out the big guns for a certain population. How about the Republicans? Who have they enlisted as surrogates?
Well, you know, so Donald Trump has had his daughter come and stump for him. Governor Christie from New Jersey has had the governor of Maine and the governor of Maryland come out and stump for him as well.
Well, okay, so not all surrogates are necessarily recognizable on the national stage. So what do you think the advantages of having someone like Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey knocking on doors for you?
Well, so apparently it serves a couple of purposes, right? In addition to have them knocking on doors and trying to, you know, plead their case to voters in New Hampshire, you've got volunteers who are working on the campaign who, by this point, may be getting a little fatigued, shall we say. It's a long slog. So it helps to kind of fire up your volunteers and your base on that level. Because for the political junkie, that might be a big deal to have Maura Healey knock on your door. For, you know, soccer mom, maybe not so much. I don't know.
I don't know if I'd even know her.
That's the other thing. Some folks, you know, don't recognize some of these people who are knocking on their doors. Other people, like, you know, I spoke to the Attorney General Maura Healey. She said she got a few kind of looks like, you look really, you know, familiar. But she is local and on television. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan, probably less recognizable. Definitely said he did not get so many looks of recognition. And he himself even kind of, you know, wondered and had to think, like, what am I doing here? People don't want to see me. They want to see Hillary. But at the end of the day, he said he was very well received.
Hillary is trailing behind Bernie Sanders here in New Hampshire. Any evidence that shows that the quality or the quantity of political surrogates can actually translate into more votes?
Well, I mean, it's kind of an insider's game. So that is more of a let me show kind of the political chattering class, so to speak. These are the folks who are lining up with me, donors, influencers. Does it translate to voters? I mean, I think that remains, you know, to be seen.
Akilah Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Akilah Johnson, she's a political reporter for the Boston Globe covering the New Hampshire primary. And you can catch a link to her article on political surrogates on the campaign trail here in New Hampshire at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, this election cycle is full of people claiming to be political outsiders who are taking on the establishment. In their series, Contenders, producers Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries profiled one of the most genuine political outsiders in recent memory, Shirley Chisholm.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America.
Direct from our newsroom in New York, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
A new hat, rather a bonnet, was tossed into the Democratic presidential race today, that of Mrs. Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to serve in Congress.
My name is Robert Gottlieb. In 1972, I was on the campaign of Shirley Chisholm. The people running were Richard Nixon on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, there was George McGovern, John Lindsay, Senator Scoop Jackson, Governor George Wallace. And then you have Shirley Chisholm, and it was like she came from Mars.
I am not the candidate of Black America, although I am black and proud. I am not the candidate of the women's movement of this country, although I am a woman, and I'm equally proud of that. I am the candidate of the people. And my presence before you now symbolizes a new era in American political history.
She looked different. She sounded different. She had a lisp. Plus, she had an accent. She was from the Caribbean. She sounded funny. But all of that became totally secondary once
you heard what she had to say.
I'm finding all over America that people are sick and tired of the Tweedledee-Dees and the Tweedledee-Dums who constantly flip-flap from one side to another. People are interested in having candidates that are truthful, candidates that have, if you will, just a tiny bit of morality and a tiny bit of integrity, and people that they believe they can go to sleep at night and know that they're not selling them out or selling out the communities in which they live.
My name is Barbara Lee. She was against the Vietnam War. She talked about the elimination of poverty and why we needed to put resources into public education.
The black vote will play a large part in the Democratic presidential primary in California next Tuesday. The two men, plus a third candidate, Representative Shirley Chisholm, are going after those black votes.
Vote for Shirley Chisholm. Give me a vote because I need strength. If I have the strength, we can get the input.
She knew that, you know, she was not going to pull the traditional voters. But she also knew there were so many people unregistered and out there just waiting to participate and waiting to vote.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I conclude by saying, if you can't support me or you can't endorse me, get out of my way. You do your thing and let me do mine.
The thing about Shirley Chisholm, she wasn't just a radical politician mouthing off. She understood how politics worked and how to get her positions heard by a wider audience.
ABC News originally had invited Senator McGovern and Senator Humphrey, the two leading candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination, to appear on this program. Friday night, the federal appeals court ruled that Mrs. Chisholm must also be invited to participate.
She could make a million speeches while all these white guys are running for president. Nobody was going to listen to her. Nobody was going to cover it unless she was a candidate for president, unless in one of the debates she could force her way onto the stage.
If your own candidacy for the top spot should fail, are you now saying that you think you could serve as vice president of the United States?
I could serve as president of this country, believe it or not.
Well, I phrased my question. Sure.
That's what you're a candidate for.
Let me go back.
That's why I'm running.
Let me go back and try it again.
Will the convention of the Democratic Party please come to order?
I was a Shirley Chisholm delegate on welfare, first time voting, you know, now delegate at a convention. I mean, that was unheard of.
There are those in this hall who feel the Democratic Party has, for much too long, been in the control of middle-aged squares. Others who feel the party is being turned over to the hippies. 4 years ago, there were people out in the streets in Chicago protesting what was happening inside the hall, demanding some of the power. This time, 4 years later, they are inside, and they have some of the power. Well, that's the kind of convention we're about to have, and we'll see what happens.
Balloting will continue until a nominee is selected. The clerk will call the roll.
Illinois, New York.
Once it became clear she was not going to get over the top in the number of delegates, we hoped we were going to be able to go in the back room and trade off our delegates for certain promises to affect what the Democratic Party would stand for. And I guess the disappointment that we all had was by the time we reached the convention, we just didn't have enough power.
Now we see the beginnings of a very powerful movement in this country, a movement that has only realized its potential power.
Congressman Ron Dellums from California was somebody who she was very close with. He was going to nominate Shirley Chisholm on the floor of the convention, but he made a determination that he could only go so far as a matter of principle with Shirley Chisholm, and he backed out.
I therefore am now endorsing the candidacy of Senator George McGovern.
It really broke Shirley Chisholm's heart that people who supported her positions ultimately decided, you know what, I love you, Shirley, but I'm going to go and support George McGovern because that's reality.
Senator George H. McGovern, having received a majority vote of this convention certified delegate.
Shirley was a very practical politician, and she knew what had to be done, had to be done. And you know, she would say, but we've got to keep going. We've got to keep working. We've got to fight. Nothing is easy.
I think every politician always has a dream that they could win, but there is no way Shirley Chisholm ever thought she would actually win the nomination or be president of the United States. But by the end of the campaign, people were no longer saying that she had no right to run.
I stand before you today to repudiate the ridiculous notion that the American people will not vote for a qualified candidate simply because he is not white or because she is not a male. I do not believe that in 1972 the great majority of Americans harbor such narrow and petty prejudices. All of you who share this vision, from New York to California, from Wisconsin to Florida, our brothers and sisters on the road to national unity and a new kind of America.
And that piece was produced by Sarah Freemark and Joe Richman of Radio Diaries.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Normally, we issue a warning when introducing something unsuitable for children, but this topic may be best suited for the 8 to 12 set. In fact, it generally reduces them to fits of laughter. We are talking about one of the lowest common denominators of humor, and maybe of humanity itself. Source of cheap laughs in Hollywood comedies, reliable vector for frat boy humor, and of course...
Hey! 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 Time for a few fart jokes. Where would a comedy show be without a few fart jokes?
George Carlin there, a master of the form, carrying on a tradition that has been with us since ancient Sumeria, the fart joke. Well, before you think we've stooped too low, there is a largely unknown history of professional flatulence, a once profitable calling that our guest Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie says has been killed by the internet. She wrote about what may be the world's oldest joke for Atlas Obscura. And Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Have people always told flatulence jokes?
I can only imagine that they have. I mean, for as long as people have been farting, it has to have been funny.
What makes them so funny?
I think, and you know, this is the result of weeks of research, I think it's largely about the fact that you can't control them sometimes. They are a reminder that we are all at heart sort of physical beings, that, you know, the loftiest lord and the lowliest maidservant, everybody farts. And I think that a lot of times it's, especially when it's really funny, it's usually when it's sort of puncturing pretension in a way. Those tend to be the kind of funniest jokes, when maybe there's a fart at a too solemn occasion. You know, it's also about the timing. So obviously not all farts are funny. You know, say your spouse does it, it's not always that funny. But when it is, it can be really, really funny because everybody does it. It is the lowest common denominator. It's accessible humor for everyone.
Well, you trace the history of those who were hired to do it on cue. So let's class this up a little bit with Roland Le Sassier, Roland Le Fateur, Roland Le Petour, some aliases for a man named Roland the Farter. Who was he?
I know, it sounds so much better in French, doesn't it? He was a court minstrel to the 12th century English king Henry II, we think. To be perfectly honest, the historical record on him isn't entirely clear, but it's evident that he existed. And his job was that every year at Christmas, he performed a dance that ended with one jump, one whistle, and one fart, all executed at the same time. And for this, he was awarded a manor house in Hemingstone, Suffolk, here in England, and more than 100 acres of land. He did pretty well by
his
farting.
Nice work if you can get it.
I mean, especially too, by medieval standards, that was about sort of one-fifth of what a knight would have been awarded.
Well, not only English kings employed those with the talent for willful flatulence. How has this played out in Western and non-Western culture?
Well, it seems to be that there's always been somebody who farts for money or farts for performance in almost every culture. You know, predating Roland the Farter, St. Augustine of Hippo wrote about people in the street who would be able to fart at will without stink, he noted, and make it sound almost as if they were singing from their behinds. Now, that was in, I think, the 4th century, so it's clearly been around for quite a long time. In Japan, especially during the Edo period, there was a man who used to perform in Tokyo on the street, and he called himself the Mist Descending Flower Blossom Man. And in 1774, his big thing was farting. And one of the people who studied him said that it was a modulated aria coming from his bottom. Something along those lines.
Well, okay, so I am clearly, about a middle schooler when it comes to this stuff, because I find them so funny. But I admit I was pretty shocked at how many books and histories and research papers there are on the subject once I started looking. There's a kind of a hidden history. So why so obscure? I mean, everybody thinks they're funny, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. And I mean, I also sort of come from the school that believes that everything has a history and everything is interesting in some fashion. So it doesn't surprise me that something as common to everyone as farting would have left an historical trace. And so, you know, going all the way back to the ancient Sumerians, the first funny joke was something about a woman farting in her husband's lap. Mentions of farting in the historical record, mentions of being flatulent, they pop up quite a lot. And so there's actually quite a lot to look at, in culture, in how farting is treated, in how it's made funny. You know, in the medieval culture, for example, there were several plays, and a lot of them that were about farting, these comic plays, tended to kind of hinge upon things like women farting and how funny and unexpected and sort of weird that was. It sometimes would hinge on, say, a sort of higher up person in the feudal society farting and that kind of, you know, taking them down a notch, things like that. So what the fart means almost changes somewhat throughout history, but it is this sort of thread that continues throughout time. So I think, you know, studying it is, you're going to find out a lot about the culture, I think, that it comes from and why they think this is funny.
Well, there's no polite or graceful way to say what we're talking about today, so just going in. Linda Rodriguez-McRobbie is with us. She wrote about the largely undiscussed but well-studied history of Roland Le Farter and other big players in the skill of professional flatulence, trying to toss aside any potty humor to explore a subject considered lowbrow and juvenile, but clearly enjoyed throughout history by kings and saints and aristocrats and, of course, teenage boys. Well, you discovered quite the sensation in France at the turn of the century. Le Petoman, what was his act?
Well, Le Petoman means literally the maniac farter. And he was a man called Joseph Pujol. And he discovered that he had this amazing ability to draw in air through his backside and release it as and when he wanted. This was pretty much the entirety of his show. Joseph Pujol was the subject of major fascination and even a study by a curious physician who published a report on him in 1904 titled, "An Extraordinary Case of Rectal Breathing and of Musical Anus." He performed on the stages of the Moulin Rouge. He had taken his act around France for a bit, and he was a hit. I mean, he would do things like fart out versions of Au Clair de Lune, the Marseillaise. He could do impressions. He would do impressions of dressmakers tearing fabric. And, you know, he had named farts like the mother-in-law and the little girl and things like that. And people just loved him. They just thought he was hilarious.
They thought it was hilarious. I mean, did they consider it crude? I mean, was there ever a time when this kind of thing was okay in society?
That's a really good question. I think there's never been a time where everyone thought it was okay. I mean, even, you know, during the medieval era, when it may have been a little bit more common to see farters at court, there were people sort of, you know, for example, John of Salisbury condemned it as totally lowbrow and not worthy of the, you know, higher figures at the time. He just thought it was awful. There's always going to be an element of society who looks down on it, which is probably why it's still funny.
But the tradition carries on. You included one performer who actually made it to Britain's Got Talent in 2009. Now, here's just a little promo video.
Hi, and you are?
Mr. Methane. I am a performing flatulist. And?
Just do it.
Okay, certainly. Tonight, ladies.
Mr. Methane on Britain's Got Talent.
Yes.
Who is he?
Oh, he's a really nice man. His name is Paul Oldfield. That's his real name. Professionally, he's known as Mr. Methane, and he has been a performing flatulist since 1991. He got his start at comedy clubs, booked into, you know, gigs on, you know, at like university end of year parties, corporate events, things like that. And he just started to become somewhat more famous. Now, this was all through the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s. So times have changed for him, I think, to a significant degree, and not entirely for the better. But his act is basically very similar to what Lupetomane was doing. You know, he can, and still does, blow out birthday candles with the air that he's able to take into his backside. He can, you know, toot along with songs, and he's a bit old school in that way, I think.
And Methane, of course, the British pronunciation of methane, so it all is appropriate. Made a few albums, a few club gigs. But compared to Roland the Fateur, who was given lands and quite a lot of material wealth, can one still make a living as a flatulist?
Well, unfortunately for Mr. Methane, I think that things aren't going so well. He did very well for the last 25 years. But I think the internet in particular has made things rather difficult for him. I mean, basically, because you can see his act online and you can pretty much get the gist of it within about 3 minutes, you don't really need to go see him live anymore. And he doesn't make any money off of people seeing him online. And to be honest, like as a journalist, I can kind of, you know, as a freelance journalist, I can really relate, because you're putting your product out there online, and views and people seeing it doesn't necessarily translate to material wealth for you. So he's found that it's important for people to see him, but that's not necessarily translating to, you know, more gigs for him, tours, things like that.
Well, last count, 1,123 apps dedicated to flatulence. It was the bread and butter, really, of early app culture, though I did notice it's been banned from the Apple Watch. So, you know, it's something that people enjoy, people listen to. I noticed that you posted this on what Atlas Obscura called No One's Watching Week. How did you get this past your editors?
Yeah. My editor there had posted a thing on Twitter asking for a post for this. And I was like, I really need to come up with something good for No One's Watching Week. Like, what do I have in my coffers that is, you know, the kind of thing that people might not normally take a chance on, and I just happened upon Roland the Farter, so
it was
a gamble that paid off.
Well, Linda Rodriguez McRobbie, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Linda Rodriguez McRobbie wrote The True Story of Roland the Farter and How the Internet Killed Professional Flatulence for Atlas Obscura. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org, and for the heartier souls, to watch some videos. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, if you're a fan of this show, you know you can always catch it here on NHPR or on NHPR online or by downloading the Word of Mouth podcast. But now we're introducing another podcast called the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. That's where we go behind the scenes with renowned authors to find out what really goes into their work. 10-Minute Writer's Workshop with Salman Rushdie. So what do you think is harder to write, the first sentence or the last?
Oh, Well, they're both difficult, but the first sentence is harder, because I think the first sentence is what sets the whole book going. You know, I mean, Joseph Heller, you know, the author of Catch-22, used to say that all his books started with a sentence, that he found this sentence and he realized that it contained several hundred more sentences. Yeah, so with Catch-22, yeah, there's a famous sentence about, you know, when the moment your Yossarian saw the chaplain, he fell in love with him. And that's the birth of Catch-22. And so I know what that feels like. I mean, I've had it once or twice to come up with a sentence and thinking, oh, now I know exactly how it goes. It goes like this.
But yeah. Do you spend a lot of time thinking about, okay, before you even said anything to Paige?
No, but I mean, the first sentence quite often changes, you know. I mean, like when I wrote Midnight's Children, the original first sentence was, most of what matters in our lives takes place in our absence. And I thought, okay, it's a perfectly good sentence, but it sounds too Tolstoyan, you know, and if there's one thing this book is not, it's not Anna Karenina. And so the sentence is still there in the book somewhere, but I buried it. I took it away from the beginning and found a different beginning.
So are there habits that you would advise writers to engage in or to take up or to even avoid?
No, I think writers are very quirky people, mm-hmm. you know, and everybody has their own habits. And some people, writers I've known, have to have a set of familiar objects around them arranged in an exact relationship to each other, you know, before they've created the magic space in which they can write. And I don't do that.
What's typically in your magic space?
I mean, I used to be very conservative about where I could write, that I would have to write in my particular workroom and have my books around me and so on. And then at a certain point, I just thought, that's nonsense. You've got to be able to do it wherever you are. And so now I can. I mean, I can't write on the road in times like this, because book tours are just too busy, but I mean, I can actually write anywhere now. I don't need to be in my familiar space.
Well, you've been writing for a long time. Is that a discipline that took you some time?
It took me some time, yeah. I'm a slow starter.
Do you write as much now as you used to?
No, but I probably finish as much as I used to, but it goes differently. I mean, when I was younger, I used to write a lot more a day, but it needed much, much more fixing. It would need a lot of rewriting.
Do you do that as you go, or do you generally wait until the end?
I do it as I go, and then I do it again mm-hmm. at the end. But now what happens is I write much less in a day, but it feels much closer to finished. Mm-hmm. So it probably takes me about the same length of time to write a book. It's just that the process is different. You know?
What is your absolute worst distraction or easiest thing to get you off track?
Baseball.
So do you write it all during the
season? No, it's very difficult. I mean, if the Yankees make the postseason, it's really complicated. If you're right, finishing a book at the same time, that's really bad for the book.
So what do you think the most common mistake is that new writers make?
I think they listen to too many people, you know. Because characteristically now, a lot of writers come out of some kind of MFA program or something, and those programs encourage you to share and workshop your work and you know, so on. And that's, I'm sure that's perfectly good kind of learning process, you know, but when you're doing it, when you know, it's when you're not at college anymore, my feeling is don't show it to too many people.
Really? So did you ever do that when you were a younger writer, developing?
No. I had this strong instinct to hug it to myself until a point which comes when, if you're any good, you realize that you're no longer making it better. Mm. You're just pushing things around and making them different, you know. And that's what I call finishing. And at that point, I become very interested in what other people have to say. Then I show it to people and I want their feedback, and I do things as a result of the feedback. I mean, especially if two or three people read it and agree that the same thing is a problem, then they're right, you know, and then you have to fix it. So Yeah, I think young writers these days are so trained in that collective act of reading each other's work and discussing it and, you know, producing the work through this kind of workshop process. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fine. That's fine as a learning process. It's not great as a, in my view, when you're actually writing.
Are there any tools or sources or books that you would recommend consulting when writing?
Well, I mean, whenever I'm writing a book, I read around the book quite widely. You know, that's to say, whatever the book throws up, that which could be the lyrics of a pop song or a 17th century Dutch painting, or it could be anything that suddenly comes into your mind, then you have to go and find out about it. You know, because the one thing I've learned is never trust your memory at such times, because that's when you make mistakes. If you think you know a poem so well that you can quote it without looking it up, you will misquote it. So, there's actually one mistake in this book which I'm going to have to fix. There's a mistake about the movie Ghostbusters.
No, of all things.
Of all things, there is.
Is nothing sacred?
No, I've said, I've got to fix it. I confess to you the mistake that I say in the novel that Sigourney Weaver is possessed by the supernatural being, yeah, Gozer the Gozerian, but she isn't. She's possessed by Zool. Zool, who is the gatekeeper.
Really, I hope people can forgive you for this.
You know, it's just because I didn't check. It's one of those, exactly that thing, right, that because I thought I knew, I didn't check, and therefore I got it wrong. So I'm going to have to fix it. There's all these copies already printed.
So what is the best piece of advice you ever received about writing?
I suppose the best piece of advice was something that my old history professor at Cambridge, Arthur Hibbert, said to me about the writing of history. He said, you should never write history until you can hear the people speak. He said, because if you don't know that, then you don't know enough about them and you can't tell their story. And I've since then thought of that as very good advice for how you make characters. You know, you have to think about how do they talk? Are they talkative? Are they taciturn? You know, how big is their vocabulary? What's their accent? An accent can reveal class and it can reveal location. So once you answer for yourself a number of questions about exactly how the character speaks, you actually know quite a lot about them, and they've begun to come to life.
Any rules you follow about grammar or structure? Or
oh, I'm kind of a grammar Nazi. Yeah. I am. I get very, very annoyed by spelling mistakes and by ungrammatical sentences, such as you find in the work of E.L. James.
For example?
I don't remember. I'm not a great scholar of the work of E.L. James.
So you must know how to spell Zool now.
I do, with two U's.
Salman Rushdie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Salman Rushdie speaking with me backstage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. You can hear more episodes of the 10-Minute Writers Workshop at our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or by searching 10-Minute Writers Workshop in iTunes. And we'd love more people to hear the podcast, so if you enjoyed it, please rate it on iTunes. We are always happy to have you listening, and there is, of course, a deep list of segments to hear, to post on social media, or to email to friends, all at wordofmouthradio.org. And we have a gallery online today that is especially worth your while. A look at all the male candidates competing in the presidential race, sporting a wide variety of facial hair. So depending on how you look at it, they either appear very historically and grandly presidential, or like they got a hipster makeover. We promise it is worth a look on our Facebook page, on Twitter, or at wordofmouthradio.org. And please join our peak beard political movement and spread it around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.